Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Kopernik Global Investors First Quarter 2020 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Qasim Ghaffar. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. Hello and good afternoon. First and foremost, as a firm, we wish the best of health to everyone and the families, and we would like to thank everyone for their continued support in these challenging times. Thank you for joining the call today for the first quarter 2020 conference call. My name is Qasim Ghaffar, and I have with me David Iben, our CIO and the portfolio manager for the Kopernik Global All Cap Strategy and CoPM for the International Strategy. Please note, Dave will be referring to the presentation, which can be found on our website at www.kopernikglobal.com under the News and View section. Before I pass the call over to Dave for the bulk of the time, I'd like to give everyone a quick firm update. From an overall AUM standpoint, the firm assets at the end of the first quarter were right around $3.1 billion. The bulk of our change in our AUM had been due to negative market action, but given our strong relative performance during this period, overall flows for the firm have been stable, and a net flow base will be pretty much flat for the year. Also, on a personal level, we are well-staffed with 37 people strong, with no turnover, and also our portfolios are well-positioned, we believe, to take advantage of the market dislocation. I also want to mention that Dave recently finished a new commentary called The Call of the Wild, and that can also be found on our website. And with that, Dave, please go ahead.
All right. Thanks, Qasim. Thanks to everybody for joining in. Certainly, every quarter is an interesting quarter, but none more than this one. Usually skip over this page, but we've always prided ourselves on independent thought. But never more than now, when it looks like to us, this is a period of groupthink and a period of market insanity. Fortunately, it's also a period with unparalleled opportunity. Before we get into the opportunities, though, let's start with the bad news. After a number of bad years for value investing, particularly the last 3 years have been very tough, this quarter was a massive acceleration of that underperformance. People didn't hit the momentum stocks that hard, and they came back faster. Value got hit particularly hard. It's just even this week, so far, what I've heard, the NASDAQ has outperformed the Dow by 6.5% in 4 days. And the Dow, of course, has outperformed most every other market in the world, which leads us to not only has it been bad times for value, it's been bad times for anything outside the U.S. As this chart shows, a dozen years of markets, once you take the U.S. out, the markets have done nothing. For a dozen years, certainly the economies have grown, businesses have grown, the number of bargains out there has grown. So we will let other people buy the market that is up three times, despite the fact that pre-tax income in aggregate has not grown for a number of years in the U.S. The amount of debt has grown a lot. So that, we think, is a market to be avoided. You might have seen this chart. It gets around from time to time, showing that you get extremes when market tops. In 99, the top five companies became a huge percentage of the market, and less so in 07 because that wasn't really a bubble. It was a mortgage problem. But now here we are right up there at 99 levels. Five companies are 18% of the entire S&P 500, only 14% of the earnings, and we'll see how the earnings hold up. So extremes in the market are also the right time, we believe, to run from index funds and get to actively managed funds that aren't mindlessly playing the momentum stocks. Moving on to page 9. This is a slide we showed before. We found it amusing a few years ago that one company, Apple, had a larger market cap than Russia, one of the top 10 economies in the world. Now, it's bigger than Russia. Throw Brazil in there, too, another top 10 economy. You can get two countries for the price of one company. These are things we think you only see at market tops also. So, they're throwing a lot of money at this market, but somehow the economics is going to need to support that. Moving on, page 10, this is an expanded version of the last chart. If you take the four largest market caps in the U.S., Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, the four of them add up to $4.2 trillion. That's before today. Amazon, last I looked, was up $50 billion today. That is what it is. Canada, South Korea, Brazil, Russia, all in the top 12 economies of the world, have a market cap of less than $4 trillion. So four companies have a bigger market cap than four of the largest economies in the world. And by the way, Canada, Brazil, and Russia, I don't even know what percent of the world's land they own, what percent of the world's resources they own. So when the market gets completely off its rocker like this, it's really the most exciting time to be an active investor. Which leads us to the opportunity set. We'll start with a glimpse of the dislocations, and then we'll dig deeper. But for starters, U.S. versus international versus global. We've showed various forms of this before. 57% of the ACWI index is in one country, and that country on purchasing power parity is 15%. 57% of the cap, 15% of the economics, another disconnect. The opposite side, the flip side of that coin, 12% of the ACWI is emerging markets. China alone is 19% of the economics on purchasing power. And then you throw in India and Russia and all that, you're getting over half of the world's economy for 12%. And then, as you might expect, the valuations reflect that. The S&P right now is 2.5 times sales and 12 times cash flow, 10 times tangible book, 19, almost 20 times earnings. And, of course, the earnings are vastly overstated, as I'm sure you've read. If you move from the U.S. to the non-U.S. companies, you get things at half price. 1.4 times sales, cash flow, not quite half, tangible book, 80% discount. And then once you get into global all-cap value, you can see our portfolio less than 1 time sales, less than half of tangible book, 7 times earnings, 2.5 times cash flow roughly. So by venturing beyond the U.S., you get way more opportunities at way cheaper price. So, when 57% of the index is in one country, be warned. We've updated a chart we've shown you a few times in the past. You know, the market loves certainty, but when it comes to the future, there is no certainty. So what the market loves is a perception of certainty. A misperception of certainty is probably a better way to go about it. So we've shown them that, we've shown you in the past, and as you've all read, 10-year bond, if you give them certainty, they will take the certainty of a loss. Half a percent loss, guaranteed. That's what they'll take for that. And as you get a little further from bonds, but still like acting like bonds, you still get next to no yield. Then when you migrate a little further to quality growth stocks and things like that, that are very bond-like in their characteristics, they, of course, have run to very, very high prices, even with this correction. High-yield bonds weren't yielding anything, and that's changed quickly in the last few months, although now it comes down to which ones are the beneficiaries of government largesse and which ones are not. But what's happened since then is a wonderful bifurcation has widened. So you still get nothing for bonds. Got a little better in Europe. It's gotten way worse in the U.S., where you now get typo here, but you get 60 basis points worth of yield for a 10-year bond. Meanwhile, if you're willing to go into emerging markets, or you're willing to go into companies that have lots of assets that are worth a lot of money, timing unknown, real bargains have just become bigger bargains after the meltdown of last month. So with our portfolio, we will let other people own bonds. You know, how did Ray Dalio put it? That you have to be crazy to own bonds now. And we would extend that to derivatives of bonds, things that are closely related to bonds and price-like bonds. But if you want yield, you have to have things that are really attractive, but people don't have the certainty. We've broken that into two forms. The traditional, what everybody loves quality franchises. We do too. They're overpriced in the U.S. and part of Europe. They are not other places, and so we have bought market leaders, number one or two in the world, low-cost producers, biggest, best at what they do, at really bargain prices, because they're not in people's first choice of where to be. And we have these asset-rich companies that are likely to make four or five times our money, timing unknown. So this gives a synopsis. It's roughly half and half. The traditional value, PE of under 7, price to cash flow 4.5, less than half of book value, dividend yield even 5.3. And then you segregate out the companies that have lots of assets but might not be selling them yet, therefore no earnings or cash flow. And that part of the portfolio in aggregate still has earnings, still has cash flow, but has what our calculations show is to be more than 400% upside from here. Throw it all together, 3.4% yield, bargain prices, and yeah, 2.5 times upside from here. So let's dig a little deeper. Like I mentioned, who doesn't like good, stable, solid businesses, and not a whole lot of things better than telecommunications? Yeah, a lot of people are going to lose their jobs, which is unfortunate. The last thing they're going to miss a payment on is their cell phone. And, you know, Verizon reflects that. It's a great company at a reasonable PE, but there is no book value, and the price you're paying per subscriber, $3,700, is very high. We have no problem with Verizon. We just noticed that if we're able to buy the number one, two sort of players in China and Korea and places like that, we can pay single-digit PEs, and we can pay half of book value. And instead of paying $3,600 per subscriber, we can pay between $200 and $600 per subscriber. We're getting the same quality, we believe. Technology leaders in the world, bargain prices. Those of you that have known us for a few decades know how much we used to love the railroads. We own pretty much everyone in North America except for the CN. They were bargains. They had underperformed for decades, and now they're up a lot. They deserve to be up a lot, maybe not this much. Then we were able to buy Japanese railroads after the unfortunate events of Fukushima. Now they've run up a lot. Now it's Hong Kong and China people are worried about. And for that reason, instead of paying 5.5 times book for Union Pacific, we can pay 0.35 times book value for the Guangxing. Instead of paying 17 times earnings, we can pay 13 times earnings. And that's in a growth economy. That sounds interesting to us. We mentioned we're not a fan of bond proxies. Utilities are bond proxies. And you can see that the Dow Jones Industrial Index has run up to over twice book value. It is 20 times earnings. Maybe it's worth it. We'll leave that to others. We will buy similar companies market share leaders, the biggest and best in the world. What we have here, the two biggest and best, hydroelectric, cheap, clean, no greenhouse gases, not two times book, 0.8 and 0.46. Earnings, 3.5 times. Russ Sider had a write-up, if you don't count that, 6.7 times earnings. And then we have a distribution company at a quarter of book value and 2.6 times book value. Or 2.6 times earnings, I'm sorry. 2.6 times earnings versus 20 times for the U.S. utilities. You know our choice. We could go on and on. We have quite a few of these sort of companies in the portfolio. Like I mentioned, half the portfolio. The other half is the beneficiaries of what we call latent value. Some of you have endured our presentations with dams that on one side show a desert and on the other side show a bunch of water burning into the top. And if one's looking for water and their analysis stops short of the dam, they're going to miss that value. We are finding a lot of things like that, things that have been trading way below the incentive cost, things that must go up a lot in price or supply will disappear in the future. And so it won't surprise you. We'll start with gold. Let's get that out of the way. finally, the market seems to be figuring out that printing a boatload of money is good for gold. And so gold, fortunately, is having a run. Is it expensive? No. Let's look at this. This is gold. The red line is relative to the theoretical value that if we were back on a Bretton Woods system where you partially back gold, you can see it's worth multiples of where it's selling now. If we ever went all the way back to a pure gold standard, not going to happen, but gold is worth way, way more than it is here. But, this talk of they're going to print $2 trillion, no, $4 trillion, they make that $8 trillion. And what is it really going to be? Well, they've told us what it's really going to be. Whatever it takes is how much money they're going to print. And you guys pay attention to the fundamentals out there. Whatever it takes is going to be a colossal number. So gold is way undervalued, and if they print more, gold's much more undervalued. But that's not the interesting part. The interesting part, and you've seen this before, gold above the ground is cheap relative to dollar bills. And gold below the ground is really cheap to gold above the ground. So once you mine this and bring it to the surface, people will pay a lot more for it. Even when they see a company producing, they'll pay more for that than the companies that aren't producing. So we've taken advantage of that and own lots and lots of gold with companies that aren't producing yet. And then we have a lot that are producing as well. So gold's cheap. Gold miners are really, really cheap. And within gold miners, if one is willing to venture north of the border or into Australia or into South Africa, one can get bigger bargains. So Newmont's a good company. They'll do well. They're probably undervalued. They are nowhere near as undervalued as our Australian name, Newcrest, who's very well run, one of the biggest in the world. But on a reserve basis, you're paying less than half as much. On a price to book, you're paying a lot less. On a price to earnings, you're paying a lot less. So every which way, it's a lot cheaper. And then those willing to venture into South Africa can get big bargains from there. All right, that's it for gold. We're not going to bore you with that anymore. Actually, for the first time in a long time, used to be gold was cheap as money, but it was also the cheapest, you know, quote, commodity we could find. No longer the case. Gold's been going up for the last 12 years. Commodities have been going down for the last 12 years. And so now we find a lot of things interesting. Now let's quickly go through some of this. Silver, 120 years ago, Williams Jennings Bryan was running for president on bimetallic standard. I will not be crucified on a cross of gold. He wanted 16 to 1 silver. That was the ratio back then, 16 to 1. Now it's 116 to 1. the right price people can argue about, but this is the biggest it has ever been. Silver has lots of uses, and if current events continue, silver will be craved as money again. So we have exposure to companies, some that are pure silver, a lot that are gold that have silver as well. Silver is undervalued relative to gold. Platinum. Wasn't that long ago, it seems, that platinum sold for almost twice the price of gold. Twice. Now it's 60% discount. Twice the price of gold to a 60% discount. We think platinum's undervalued. It wasn't that long ago you were hearing economists talking about maybe the Fed should come up with a $1 trillion platinum coin. We haven't heard that nonsense in a while, but I think if things continue, you will see more demand for platinum coins. It will be monetized. We got kind of lucky. Our platinum play also turned out to be a palladium play, so we made a lot of money on that. But that was pure luck. Now it's platinum that people should be interested in, we think. You hear so much about nickel and how it's the most important component by far in these batteries for EVs. If you look at Tesla stock, every one of us are going to own EVs in the next 5 years. But yet the price of nickel is, look what it's done. It is a small fraction of where it was 12 years ago. That's at a time period where gold's gone up 2.5 times. Nickel's lost 70-80% of its value. So that, we think, is pretty fascinating. Also, a battery, nickel. Look at how hyped batteries were 2 years ago, where the price of cobalt did. Now it's down. A year ago, we were able to find a small cobalt play that got taken out. So not a whole lot of ways to play that. Copper is, of course, another beneficiary of electronic and especially electronic vehicles. It's helped us in recent years. When the market loves copper, we tend to trim our names, such as Turquoise Hill and Ivanhoe, that have more copper. And then when they hate copper, we buy them. And when they love it again, we trim them. And now they hate copper. And so Ivanhoe and Turquoise Hill are, in our opinion, grossly undervalued. And if these keeps up, we'll be looking for others. Leaving the metals. We go to page 28. Oil is something we haven't owned much of in the last dozen years. But you might recall in 2016 when oil hit $28, we bought some. We figured, you know, reasonable men can argue about whether it should be 40 or 80 or 90, but 28 was a joke. And, of course, it didn't stay there very long, and that worked out well. We sold most of them. Over the last year, we're back in oil, mostly in Canada. And you can see we thought 28 was cheap. 19 is something altogether. It's not sustainable. We don't know timing. It's not sustainable. And the oil stocks, of course, are down as much or more than oil. Something that we haven't done much with over the years other than Gazprom, which is its own vehicle, is natural gas. But over the last year, the natural gas stocks were down over 80%. We bought one of them, which fell another 80%. And we've bought others recently, more timely. Same thing here. I've watched natural gas bounce between $1.70 and $14 back and forth my whole career. It's back under $2. Not sustainable. Demand for everything, of course, is down the last few months. But not counting that, people believe that natural gas was a dying industry when, in fact, it's been a growth industry. In the States, we've been selling it through LNG. We've been using it to make chemicals on plants that have been built on the Gulf Coast and elsewhere. And, of course, if electric vehicles ever catch on again, the electricity, the incremental electricity, a lot of it's going to come from natural gas. These have a little more debt than we would like, especially in this kind of environment. Fortunately, it's termed out. There is some risk to this. If anything goes right, these things are worth 20 times what they're selling at, in our opinion. So we like the risk-reward. Okay, switching again, let's go to grains. Grains have done better than metals. They've gone nowhere for 12 years, which is better than all the other commodities I was showing you, but of course left in the dust by gold, which isn't, of course, a commodity. It's money. So relative to money, commodities have become very cheap. There were times a few years ago, and again now, where we not only like the grains, we like the disconnect in the market. A few years ago, and again now, it paid off a few years ago, we were saying, why is it that companies that grow food sell for five times earnings, and companies that take that food and roll it up in a burrito and sell it 50 times earnings? And we are back there again. Some of the companies we own are three times earnings. Chipotle is over 50. It's 85 times this year's projected earnings. Same thing there. If we grow food, our company's three, four, five times earnings, throw it on a pizza crust and deliver it. Now, 38 times earnings. We love that disconnect. It turned out to be a good thing a few years ago when, of course, eventually Chipotle crashed and our stocks went up a lot. Since then, our stocks are back down. Chipotle's back up. That's an opportunity. Massive disconnects like that are an opportunity. Saving the best for last. The best being where we've been wrong the longest, I guess. But the fundamentals have been falling into place very nicely. Same thing here. You have a period where gold has held its purchasing power as they've printed too much money and the dollar has lost 80% of its purchasing power. Gold reflects that. These commodities haven't. Uranium, of course, gone from $137 to $18. Now it's around $30. It's spent the last 5 or 6 years bouncing between $18 and $30. It's up 20% this year. Other than bonds, gold and uranium are the two winners this year. They are they're both up nicely. It's good to see the market respond to money printing the way that the textbooks say they should. But anyhow, this has been a long, long drawn-out bear market, which is perfect because that's what it takes to wash out the weak producers. You had just this last month, you had two high-cost producers in Namibia close down, close the mines. Closer to home, you've had Cameco a few years ago close their best mine, and just last month close their second-best mine. You had Kazakhstan that cut production growth a few years. Well, now they're actually cutting 10 to 20% of their production. Meanwhile, best I can read, demand for nuclear power is down 3 or 4%. It's a pretty stable business. If you're a utility, one of the last things you shut down is your nuclear power plant. So pretty stable demand. Supplies disappeared. And that bodes well. And then it'll be told in the past, the government, U.S. government's not selling anymore, Russia's not selling anymore, investment funds are set up to buy it and have been taking supply off the market. Cameco's been in buying instead of selling. And as you've gotten used to with us, we love undervalued commodities, but we love much more when those very same commodities are way more undervalued when they're still underground. And we mean adjusted for the price of bringing them above ground. So this is the uranium held underground relative to the spot price. You can see uranium companies have been hit much harder than uranium has, and that is a beautiful thing. Not only can you buy really, really attractively priced uranium, but once again, the beauties of being a global investor, the U.S. has a de minimis amount of uranium. Canada and Kazakhstan put together have over half the world's uranium and most of the world's low-cost uranium. So it's a good time to be looking beyond the borders, we believe. All this volatility, we've said for a long time, volatility is not the enemy. It is not risk. Volatility is our friend. Volatility is what allowed us to buy GE below 7 a year ago, sell it at 11 in February, and buy it back again below 7 in March. So that's a great thing. Volatility was mispriced in the put option. We've been saying for 3 years, and we don't know why it took longer than any time ever in history for the market to have its correction. More and more people were saying, corrections were impossible, which let you know we were close anyhow. But we kept saying it seems like implied vol should be 20 or more with markets that high, and we've periodically bought them as low as 8 and mostly 10 to 12 and never higher than 13.5. Unfortunately, a few months ago, it was closer to 12, 13 than to 8. But fortunately, we were still able to buy this thing, and it went up like 12 times in a month. And so that was helpful. That was a source of capital. Since inception, we're still down about 2%, so 50 basis points a year. But made it all back in a month and at a very opportune time. We will not be rolling it over. What the market does from here, who knows, although we have our opinion on the NASDAQ. We can't buy these things at 8 implied vol or 10 or 12. It is 35 today, 35. So people went from thinking that a market drop is impossible to thinking it's inevitable. We never had strong opinions about which way the market was going to go, only that it does go both ways from time to time, and the option was mispriced. We're happy that it was helpful this year. It's interesting volatility. You can see the things that we reduced were mostly things reducing in February. It's hard to believe right now that it was just February that the market was the highest in the history of mankind. And so we were trimming things. And then in March and early April, able to start buying things back. And so we were able to buy, you can see, a little longer than usual list of names that we were buying. And fortunately, we had the proceeds of the put option to finance all that buying. We've been able to take advantage of that and solidify a portfolio that's trading at a huge discount to book value and cheap on almost every multiple. And in addition, that has a lot of optionality. And we plan to show you this slide for years to come. it's pretty good in any environment, but especially an environment where interest rates are at zero. To be able to double your money, it is something that is worth having patience for. Maybe that was a little long, but it was quite a quarter, and we're very, very happy with the portfolio right now. So let's stop for questions.
And if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is *1 to ask a question, and we will pause for a moment to give everyone an opportunity to signal. And we will take our first question from Rick Spiegel with Ameriprise. Please go ahead.
Thank you. To the natural gas stocks, you made reference to some balance sheet concerns and writing one stock down. I mean, Range Resources, when it was in the high teens, comprised over 4% of the portfolio. And now with it, you know, I think sub 5, it's about 1.5%. So I was just wondering if your conviction on that has changed and why it's not a higher weighting. And then, you know, are you comfortable with its balance sheet and that of Southwestern Energy? And then to the miners, could you comment again on Northern Dynasty? It seems like that's something that you've viewed with a high degree of optionality over the years, and would appreciate your thoughts.
Sure. All right, let's start with that. Northern Dynasty, I think, is a poster child for how we do things. It was back in 2015, we owned quite a bit. We owned it before that too. It's a problem child, and people don't like problem child. They don't like the fact that the company back then was duking it out with the EPA and that Hollywood stars were bad-mouthing it, and that some of the big companies that had been involved with the mine had walked away and left it. They and we didn't like the fact that the company spent money faster than we would have liked to. So much to dislike. So most people say, don't buy it then. We say, well, what's it worth? It is maybe the biggest gold reserve on the planet. 100 million ounces of gold, and now you get 60 billion pounds of copper to boot. The thing is theoretically worth tens of billions of dollars. Now they can't build it on their own, so let's just cut half of that out of the equation and say they'll bring somebody in and give them half of it for a song. Then what is it worth? And we came up with a number, and we said, we risk adjust everything we do. We say, all right, well, what do we think of management, and what do we think of the geopolitics and the battles with lawyers and the EPA, and what do we think of the fact that it's going to take quite a while to build this mine? And we hit this as hard as we hit anything. We gave them a 90% discount. And after giving them a 90% discount, we still saw upside of 40 times or something. So we bought it, and you know, we had to keep buying as they diluted the shares out. But in 2016, the thing went up 20 times, and we took a whole lot of profits, did very well on that one. And you know, had a lot of other names that were not up here nearly that much, but did pretty well. So yeah, to have things where we have 40 times upside as a percent or two of the portfolio, where we're very happy to do that. And so that worked well. Now, it's bounced around in recent years, too. They've had victories. And it's kind of interesting now because, you know, nothing went right for them 4 or 5 years ago. Now, things are going right. The Army Corps of Engineers supports what they're doing. Under Trump, the EPA is an entirely different organization than it was under Obama, for both good and bad. Maybe mostly bad, but very good for this company. They've been much more reasonable about their plan, developed a smaller plan, a better plan, a more efficient one, an environmentally friendly plan. The price of gold's gone from 1,050 to 1,700 something. Everything's gone right, and yet the stock is back by its lows. So we own quite a bit of it. And as I was saying a little earlier, if something's going to double or triple or go up 10 times or 40 times or whatever this is eventually going to do, we're willing to be patient. And I will also point out, 2016 and 2009, which was very similar, we buy these companies at 90% off sales. even if we stub our toe on one or two of them, like we did with Apex Silver in 2009 and like we did with Peabody in 2016, you can still make massive money if the rest of your names are going up 2, 4, 6, 8%, and a 20-bagger is nice also. And as far as natural gas is a typical commodity. It's a very cyclical thing. Like in gold and copper and everything else, people like to buy high and sell low. It's an unfortunate thing. The U.S. went from nothing to a big-time player in gas, financed by very low interest rates. People were pouring money in the ground. Presumably, the U.S. is one of the low-cost producers in the world. The bears will point out correctly, if that's so, how come debt goes up almost every year? Why are you guys borrowing more money than you're taking, than you're making in cash flow? The business was growing too fast for too long, and that was a time when we had no interest in it. As you mentioned, we bought it. We started buying it around 12. It bounced to 17, and we trimmed a lot. We were feeling pretty good. And then it went back to 12, 13. And as you mentioned, at that point, stock's down 90%. It was cheap on earnings. It was cheap on comparison to the reserves they have, cheap on about every measure. Management's buying it. The debt growth had stopped, and they were paying down some debt. And so we thought, now's the time to get in, 90% off and things going right. Well, hindsight, we were too early, and of course it dropped to 1-something. It's bounced recently. Do we wish we'd had a crystal ball, new one again? Yes. However, it'll move when it's going to move, and it's going to move into the 20s, we believe. All it takes is gas in the mid-2s to make a lot of money, gas in the mid-3s, which we think happens someday. This is easily worth in the mid-20s. We're happy to hold that. As to the other question, that's important. We do believe that when we can buy good companies at a good price, we are right a lot more often than we're wrong. But we expect to be wrong 30% of the time. We expect to be early most of the time. It's almost 40 years of doing this. Early is what happens with value investing. So we don't believe in putting all our eggs in one basket. So we do not put more than 5% into one name. I think in 40 years we had about 4 names go belly up on us. It's a very rare thing. Peabody was one of them. It was a big position. We made a lot of money in 2016, despite the fact that that went under, because our policy is when it's at 5, we're done. If it falls in half, we don't take it back to 5 again, and then it falls in half and we take it to 5 again. And so we like Peabody a lot, and it was 1%, but we weren't going to buy anymore, thank God. So we've had many, many names where we don't buy more and then they shoot up and we wish we would have bought more, but it's good to be disciplined. And so with Range, you mentioned it. We had a big position at 12%. When it fell in half, we could only buy 1% more, and then we bought 1% more and it fell in half again. We did not buy more, could not buy more. Fortunately, a very similar company is Southwestern, and we were able to buy that. We actually have a profit in that stock. We timed that purchase much better. And so, just like with gold or coal or anything else, we like to be buying cheap, and we also like to diversify amongst names. And so, fortunately, Range isn't the only name, but that is why you've seen Range not get built up, but what you have seen is our gas and oil position get built up to about as big as it's ever been, probably is the biggest it's ever been in my career right now. Stocks have never been this cheap. So We're more diversified than we were a year ago, and we own more. It's very, very cheap.
Thank you.
And as a reminder, that is star one if you would like to ask a question. And we will take our next question from Mark Johnson with RBF Wealth Advisors. Please go ahead.
Thank you for hosting this call today. I was introduced to you guys here in just the past few years, and so I don't have a long track record investing with you guys. It's obviously been the last two or three years pretty difficult as the market's been going up. What do you think it's going to take before investors are really appreciate the style of investing that you have? Because as we know, it's just cash flow chasing stocks that drive stock prices. We can talk about the undervalue of a stock, but if nobody is investing in that stock, the price is going to stay down. What do you think it's going to take? I mean, was this it? What am I supposed to be talking to my investors about in terms of when your style of investing is going to be rewarded in their portfolios? Thank you.
Yeah, well, let's start out with the caveats that timing's not my thing. If we were talking 3 years ago, I would have said I cannot imagine that value could underperform for another 3 years. So what do I know? This is the longest by far that value's underperformed. Once again, caveat that what do I know? I suspect that what just happened was it. It's pretty typical. Let's just say this is the end for growth. The growth is outperforming madly the last month or two. That happened in 99. In 2000, the tech bubble broke. It broke the first week of March. I remember it well. It was a godsend. But when people fall in love with stocks, they hang on to them. So tech was done. Growth was done. It was over. 4 months later, there were new all-time highs for Microsoft and Cisco and Intel and some of these guys, and that seems to be what's happening now. It's interesting how 6 months ago the market was priced for perfection, and instead of perfection, we got this. And how much is the NASDAQ down in the last 6 months? It is up. Up. And, here we have Amazon and things like that hitting new all-time highs, and people are saying this is good for Amazon. In a relative sense, this is wonderful for Amazon. Clearly, everybody's saying home ordering from Amazon is a good thing, but when you have a stock that has, not counting Microsoft or whatever, basically the highest market cap in the history of mankind, and we're going into the worst recession since the 1930s, there's a collision going to happen there. And then, of course, on the other fronts, they lost their suit with Microsoft on the defense front, and everything better go perfect for these things. So all these expensive stocks, they might do fine. I hope they do fine. But they're probably more risk than there is reward there. With value stocks, they've been underperforming, depending upon what kind of value, since 07. Our kind of value, more for the last seven and a half years, been underperforming. That's a long, long time. Has it been underperforming because the fundamentals aren't there? Are the phone companies in Korea and China down at these levels because those economies haven't grown? They've done pretty well. If you take trading companies in Japan, they've lost money once since the Second World War. The book value goes up and up and up and up. Well, we've made a lot of money on these things, but now they've gotten pretty cheap again. And did the gold stocks, they're bouncing this month, but they're selling half last month. Was gold down and gold stocks down because QE 1, 2, and 3 were, they actually exited it and took the money supply away? No. They announced QE Unlimited, and they were still hitting it. So, yeah, gold is worth more than it ever has any time in history, and the gold stocks failed to reflect that. Meanwhile, we talked to the gas stocks. You know, they all spent too much money at the top, and now they're finding religion now. Now they're paying down debt, and they're not spending money on things. The gold companies, they spent way too much money 10 years ago. They've been not spending on anything for years. Yeah, there's no way that mine supply can do anything but drop in the next few years. that's a very good thing. Most of these companies now are actually going to make a lot of cash flow this year. A lot of cash flow. Why the rest of the world is seeing massive cash flow declines, these are going to see big cash flow increases. So does it make sense that they stay cheap? Uranium prices just went up 50%, and people are still taking supply out of the market. Fundamentals have gotten way, way stronger there. And so, the point is, it's not whether value is good or bad. As Jim Grant put it in this issue, he goes, the last 10 years could make one not believe in value anymore, except for that the concept is so simple. Who could not believe in buying things for less than they're worth? Yeah, of course that's a good strategy. And growth is wonderful as long as you don't overpay for it. But in 1929 and 1972 and 1999, and I will go on record to say now, people are massively overpaying for growth. That doesn't make them bad companies. From 1972 to 1982, the Nifty 50, almost every one of them grew nicely. The stocks fell 75% over a decade. Nothing against growth stocks. They'll probably grow earnings, although not this year. And the stocks 30 years from now will probably be fine. We'll let other people own them the next 10 years. That's their deal. What we will be doing is continuing to own companies. Like I say, most of the companies in this portfolio are number one, two, or three in the world at what they do. They mostly have competitive advantages. They have sustainability. And as I pointed out, half the portfolio are things that are pretty stable. And the other portfolio is stuff with massive upside, plus positive cash flow, plus likely to benefit from all this money printing. So, I don't care if growth goes up 40% or down 40% over the next few years. Value stocks seem poised to do up a double, a triple. Not that it's going to happen. And like I say, my timing's horrendous, but the longer these things underperform and the cheaper they get, the more they're likely. And, the put option 2 months ago, was that unpopular. It's the time of maximum unpopularity that stocks do well. And this is sort of maximum unpopularity for hydrocarbons, the oil, the gas. This is maximum unpopularity for emerging markets. People hate them. I think they're all going to default. And it's no longer maximum popularity on gold and uranium, but we're still towards the unpopular side. And these values reflect them. If one believes that buying good companies at a very, very attractive price is a money-making proposition, you have to think that we're near the turn, that value's coming back.
Thank you.
And we will take our next question from Chris Matini with TIFF. Please go ahead. Caller, please check your mute function.
Hi, sorry about that. Dave, can you please distinguish between latent value and traditional value with a bit more color, maybe a quick example of each to paint the picture? Thanks.
Yeah, a lot of people say, you know, that cash flow is all that matters, and you know, we're value is the present value of future cash flows, and we say, great, who can disagree with that, except for that we don't know the future, so we don't know future cash flows, and in this world, we don't even know the discount rate. You know, most traditional value managers will say, you know, show me the money, I guess. They like to buy things that are cheap on earnings and cheap on book value and cheap on cash flow, and so do we. It's just in the United States, and until recently, a lot of other places, you had to pay too much for that. You know, hence, that I was saying earlier, I used to show all these pictures of a dam with a bunch of water on one side and a desert on the other. I would say once the person turns the valve and the water starts flowing through, people will pay a fortune for that. And so, so we have this portfolio where we do own phone companies and trading companies and utility companies, and these things are cash flow machines. That's what everybody else owns, but they don't own them in Korea and Canada and Russia and places like that, Ukraine. So we get to own traditional value just like everybody else. It's just we are long priced out of the United States. The latent value is the stuff where you have cash flow. The valve's shut right now. Nobody can see that cash flow. And whether it's next year or 2 years from now or 5 years from now, the world will see the cash flow. I talk about the present value of future cash flow. I say, well, if you have value, you'll get future cash flow. The Mona Lisa has no cash flow. So theoretically, it's worth nothing. But we know it's worth something. So the Louvre could say it's for sale. They'll probably get $1 billion for it. The cash flow will come. And so if there's an ounce of gold underground and people are happily paying $1,700, now they're paying more because you can't even get physical gold, but $1,700 is what it's worth. And so, yeah, I dig a hole and I throw that coin in there and I bury it and say, what's it worth now? The marketplace is saying, we can't see it. We'll pay $800 for it. Yeah, well, fine. I'm not going to sell it to it at $800. I'm a buyer at $800. And then I'll dig it up and I'll sell them the coin at $1,700. It's easy money with the exception of maybe I get to do it tomorrow or maybe next year or maybe 2 years from now or maybe 5 years from now. Depending on the timing, I'm either going to make 100% return on my money or 41% if it's next year or 10% of it takes 7 years. But that's what I'm saying. We know what that coin is worth. People can't see it. We want to buy it before they can see it. Once the mining company says, instead of a company sitting on reserves, we're now an operating company making money, people will pay for that. Also, the world's a cyclical place. So you have two forms. You have money underground that people can't see yet, and once you start bringing it above ground. The other thing is the fact that things go up and down in price, but they go up and down around an intrinsic price, a equilibrium price, below which people stop producing and above which people start bringing on extra production or cutting their supply. And so, if corn sells too low a price, people stop planting it and the price goes back up. And so we like to buy commodities that have been way below a price that would make anybody produce. So, people are cutting back production like crazy in natural gas now. They're cutting back production in oil right now. Like I've mentioned, almost everybody stopped producing uranium right now. People have deferred so long on producing gold that it's going to take a decade before you see any increase in mine supply. The prices will go up. And after the price goes up, people will pay for it. They all know it's going to go up. They all know it's cyclical. So if we can buy something that's going to bounce between 2 and 6 for the next 10 years, and we can buy it at 2 and sell it at 4, we are happy to do that. And so we do a lot of that. We buy things at a discount to incentive price, and then we buy it underground at a double discount to that incentive price. So that's what we mean by latent. And as I highlighted in here, that part of the portfolio, in our estimation, is worth 5.5 times what it's selling at right now. So really extraordinary. I've been in the business in 1982 and 1990 and some very cheap markets. Never seen anything like this.
And we will take our next question from Dan Gallagher with UBS. Please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. Just a couple questions. We have clients that are, uncomfortable, with, EM, emerging markets. Our country has certain strengths that foreign countries don't have. Some of these countries have a lot of dollar-denominated debt, and their healthcare system, probably can't handle, what could happen. And I'm wondering, on your point of view, I know that you guys do buy things with discount rates, but is there any of that macro? Do you have any of those macro concerns about EM, having a serious issue here from, money abandoning that area?
Let's do the short answer and then the longer answer. Macro, we leave to others. We're 100% bottom up, so we don't have the macro concerns. But as a bottom up investor, we watch other people's macro opinions. We don't have much opinion of our own until every now and then people's macro concerns seem outrageously optimistic or outrageously pessimistic. That's where we get involved. When Lula became president of Brazil 15, 20 years ago, people were so bearish on him. We were buying companies. We said, all right, maybe he's bad. Maybe instead of a 30% discount on our stocks, we should ask for a 60% discount. The market said, you have a 90% discount. We said, we'll take it. When Obama became president, everybody said, that's the end of healthcare. We owned no healthcare. After they elected him, we were able to buy Lilly and Pfizer and Amgen and Aetna. And I was thinking, all of a sudden, it's one of our biggest holdings. We're buying these things at 5 times earnings. We didn't know how good or bad Obama would be. We just figured he was not going to be the end of the healthcare system. There was 4 years ago where Putin was considered, the most evil man in the history of the world. We figure, certainly he's the guy to be concerned about, as are most politicians, but probably him more than most. The market, though, went from in 07 saying, you must own the BRICS, Russia being the R in BRICS, you must own it, to 5 years ago, you must not. Both of those are missing the most important variable, price. At what price should you own it? And so we owned none of the BRICS, really, when people loved them. And 5 years ago, how could you not want to buy a bunch of them? So what we said is, we don't want to own Russia because of the corruption and because of the malinvestment and because of the geopolitics that's been going on for 100 years and because there might even be sanctions and all these other things. We don't want to own it. On the other hand, it's a growth economy with tons and tons of resources, with lots of world-class businesses, with an educated population and almost no debt as a part of the economy. So paying full price seems stupid. Not being willing to buy things at 10 cents on the dollar seems stupid. So we want half off. And the market said, in the case of Gazprom, you can have 95% off. That worked out pretty well. And we were able to buy some of the biggest and best utilities, phone companies, banks, you name it. and that worked out really well. So now we think the U.S. is a great country. Love it here, always lived here. It's a productive economy with a reasonably good rule of law. The market views it on a scale of 10 as maybe a 15. And, yeah, so things are kind of expensive here. So we just don't have a lot here. But country by country, we're saying, all right, well, you know, if Exxon moves from here to Canada, how much of a discount? If I'm here to Australia, from here to France, from here to Russia, and we say, all right, well, yeah, we want bigger discounts in Russia than other places. Now we're seeing that everywhere. Like people go from emerging markets are the place to be. They grow faster. They got a lot more potential. The rule of law might not be great, but it's improving and blah, blah, blah. To times like now where people say they're just corrupt, horrible places and they've borrowed too many dollars. And, you know, there's hell to pay. Well, yeah, that's all true. But they're forgetting about the earlier stuff, that they're vibrant economies that are going to grow faster than the U.S. the next 20 years. And we don't just buy emerging markets. We buy companies. And so we buy a good company that just happens to be in Brazil, and just happens to be in China. And those sort of things. And then we say, how much of a discount do we want? How much of a discount because of management? How much of a discount if they have dollar-denominated debt? A much bigger discount. We've tended to avoid most of that. It's attitude, though, because when it comes to having too much debt, it's really hard to one-up Japan and the United States. We're the champions of having too much debt. And so, I think, you know, our approach is bottom up, find a company we want to own, find out what we think it's worth, discount it for debt, discount it for the emerging market. And right now, in many places, we want half off, and we're getting 40, 50, 60, 70% off. It's sort of crazy. So that's our approach. And, I think the last 2 months should tell people anything can happen. You know, 2 months ago, if you said, guess what's going to happen in the United States? The United States is going to announce they're printing $6 trillion out of thin air, and they're going to have some government people dole it out to their buddies and decide who gets what. And the meanwhile, small businesses, we're going to make you close, and we're going to order people to stay in their houses. You know, and whether that's a good thing or a bad thing they did, that's not my point. The point is, who could have imagined it happening? And it's happening everywhere. So I would say the U.S. is great. Having 100% of your money here or anywhere, that's a dangerous thing. I think that's how 100% of your money in one country is way more dangerous than if you have 2% in the Ukraine or 5% in Russia. That's my opinion. I think somebody right now should want to diversify across currencies, across debts, across management teams, across geopolitics, across industries. Now is the time to insist upon values and insist upon diversification. But it's up to each individual to decide what they're comfortable with.
In that regard, in our global portfolio, I think we're like 5% U.S. And my understanding on this big setback, 30%, you know, the S&P and small stocks down 45. The one, you know, stock that you bought was GE on the dip back. And, you know, obviously you'd done work on that. But were you close to doing something in healthcare or banking or any other sector? It doesn't seem – I know that you've got things at huge discounts overseas. I just was wondering when that correction happened, was that just the one U.S. stock that you got off?
healthcare and social media and high tech, we never got close. At the very worst, cheapest day, not close. Outside of that, yeah, it's become a lot more interesting world. We're looking at a lot of retail. We haven't looked at retail in the past. We're looking at a lot of banks. We seldom own banks. Haven't owned much since like 2010 or something. We are looking at industrials. We are looking at things that aren't tech that might be considered tech, like companies in Japan that are trading below net cash, that sort of thing. And we, also in the U.S., we did add to our energy names. And in Canada, we added to energy names. And in emerging markets, we had, just to reiterate, in case some of you don't know, we generally don't disclose the things we've done in the last month. So we were not disclosing. There was a fair amount of activity in March, some of what you're seeing, but the latter stuff you're not seeing. So we were pretty active. But in the U.S., it was mostly gas. It wasn't other things. There are a few things that got approved that we looked at. So there are names in the U.S. that are new to the approved list that we haven't bought, so I won't name them, but industrials and retail and things like that. You're right. We were fortunate. We spent a year doing research with a new analyst we had. Figured it was a good way for her to get her feet wet. We did in-depth analysis on every division they had. And then the stock fell from 20 to 9, so we bought it, and it went to 8, and we bought more, and 7, we bought more, and 6-something, and then it ran to 11, so it got to 13, but we sold at 11, figured 18, I talked about risk-adjusted, so our risk-adjusted price is around 12, so we're happy to buy at 6 and sell at 11, we'll keep doing that. I would say most industries now we are looking at, with the exception of healthcare and a lot of the high tech. Our one healthcare name, they make ventilators, so that did pretty well. We sold half of that, but that's about it.
Thank you, Dave.
Star 1 if you would like to ask a question. And we will take our next question from Dan Gallagher with UBS. Please go ahead.
Hey, Dave, you did a great job buying SkyWest once. I remember that trade being fantastic. I was wondering if what your thoughts are in general on airlines. Are these investable anywhere?
SkyWest a few weeks ago hit 10. Yeah, we originally bought it at 6 and sold it all the way up to I don't know, 35 or whatever, and then it went up to 60, I think, after we sold. At 10, we started scrambling, and then it went to 25, which is still really cheap. But just today, I was with our airline analyst going through a bunch of cash flow assumptions. What if their sales are down 90% and then bounce back in 2 years or 1 year? It's really, really cheap, and it's a really well-run organization. I think it'll do pretty well, but we suspect that their debt level may need to double or triple before this goes through. So we're going to have calls with management and talk to them about what the capital needs are and what the plan are, but that sounds pretty interesting. Airlines, in the past, we owned American once, we owned JetBlue once, in the Asia crisis, we owned Cathay Pacific. We like industries that are really important. I think all of us think our life is better off that they exist, and when people hate them, we get pretty interested in them. So, yes, we are looking at them. Although, this is interesting because, I think you've all seen all the articles that the problem for the airlines isn't the cycle. The problem is that they spent the last 5 years borrowing a bunch of money, buying their stock back at really high prices as management sold into it, and now they're big in the government for money, which I guess they got. But it looks like it's about 4 or 5 months of cash flow that they got. And so how long this lasts and how fast this picks up and how they're capitalized, and I still can't figure out, you know, what those warrants that the government may or may not take are worth. But we like airlines. We don't like too much debt. And they're ones of many, many companies now where, you know, trying to figure out who the government's going to give money to and at what rate and for how long, that's difficult. So we're not buying a whole lot of companies that have a lot of debt and are going to have negative cash flow this year, but we have a few. We've got range. And we like the idea. It'll probably take us a while to get on top of these names, and they're you know, flying, so to speak, all over the place. So, it's a good question. I wish I had a better answer, but it certainly has our interest.
Thanks.
And with no further questions, I would like to turn the call back to Mr. Eben for any additional or closing remarks.
All right. Well, it's interesting times. April's starting out a lot differently than March. Certainly, we think the volatility is crazy.